The following episode of Annals on Call is brought to you by Annals of Internal Medicine. The views and opinions expressed by the hosts and participants during this episode are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of the American College of Physicians, the editors of Annals of Internal Medicine, or the institutions that the speakers are affiliated with unless so identified. All relevant financial relationships have been mitigated. Information contained herein should never be used as a substitute for clinical judgment. For more episodes, links to CME and MOC, or to view disclosures, visit go.annals.org/oncall.
That pain wasn't necessarily related much, or if at all, with cartilage loss, which has no pain fibers in it.
Welcome to Annals on Call, a podcast based upon articles from the Annals of Internal Medicine in which we discuss the implications of the article for you, the listener. This is Dr. Bob Centaur. I'm Professor Emeritus at the University of Alabama at Birmingham and former Chair of the Board of Regents for the American College of Physicians.
This episode of Annals on Call features an article titled Obesity, Weight Loss, and Knee Osteoarthritis, the Role of Glucagon-like Peptide 1 Receptor Agonists. Joining us is Dr. David Felsen, who's one of the authors of this editorial. He's a distinguished rheumatologist and epidemiologist who's done much research on osteoarthritis and rheumatoid arthritis. He's professor of medicine and epidemiology at the Boston University School of Medicine and School of Public Health. I think you'll find this discussion very interesting, both as a reaction to the article concerning cost effectiveness, but also on the basic pathophysiology of why we have such severe knee osteoarthritis in patients with obesity. David, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast. I really enjoyed your editorial on this article about whether or not GLP-1s are cost-effective for managing knee osteoarthritis. But in order to get to the point of the editorial, which was to review that paper, I think it's worthwhile to go over the evolving concepts about knee osteoarthritis, because I know back when I was doing primary care, it frustrated the heck out of me. And I have a lot of friends who have knee osteoarthritis, and it frustrates them. So maybe you could sort of get our listeners up to date with where this field has gone over about the last 10, 15 years, and what we know about knee osteoarthritis that we probably were not as aware of in the past.
The view of what osteoarthritis is, and therefore how we manage it, has really evolved a lot in the last 10 or 20 years. I think before that time, we regarded it as a disease of cartilage damage and cartilage loss, and that was about it. And that was our focus, including the focus of drug development. And that just didn't work out very well until we started conceptualizing it as a disease of the whole joint, with pain as a prominent component of that. And the minute we started doing that, it begin to make a little more sense. We began to recognize that pain wasn't necessarily related much, or if at all, with cartilage loss, which has no pain fibers in it, that the pain was generated probably by bone damage and by synovitis, by inflammation within the synovium that secretes the fluid. And that if we were perhaps to target those tissues, in addition maybe to cartilage, that we would come up with effective therapies. And so that's been the evolution of our conceptualization of osteoarthritis. The other part of that is that we recognized increasingly that it was an inflammatory disorder. That's part of the idea that from animal studies, we learned that if we injured a joint, if inflammation was triggered as part of that injury, that the osteoarthritis and its symptoms based on behavior of the animals developed much more rapidly than if inflammation was quashed, suggesting that inflammation was a necessary precondition for the development of OA on the face of mechanical damage. So there are these two components that contribute to it. One is a mechanical damage that's usually ongoing and chronic. So patients with knee osteoarthritis present with malalignment, with varus, with knock knees or bow-leggedness, and those represent or reflect increased loads across local areas of the knee when they walk. And that's a critical element of osteoarthritis of the knee that causes problems. And then in addition, there's some inflammatory contributor to that, okay, maybe as part of the damage to the joint that triggers that inflammation, and that contributes to the pain. So we now have this more complicated, probably more comprehensive assessment and concept of what knee osteoarthritis is and why it causes so much grief. And we also, as part of that, have a better sense of why our treatments were frustratingly ineffective often. Okay. So if we dealt with just the inflammation and not maybe the mechanical elements of it, we didn't get very far a lot of the times. Or we tried therapies out like nonsteroidals that had risks associated with them that we weren't crazy about. Okay. Or we tried exercise to strengthen muscles and found that that adherence to them over time was lousy, you on average. So nothing worked terribly well. And the picture, I think it's the old Osler maxim. You know, when I see a patient walking in the door with arthritis, I walk out the back door. Okay. And so what happened, you know, what Osler is talking about is basically osteoarthritis. And that still, I think, was the perspective of many clinicians dealing with this incredibly common disabling disease.
Okay, so let me see if I can summarize and see if I get all this right. So we have damage to the bones that in a situation where there's also inflammation, that's when we start to get synovitis and some pain. And on previous podcasts, we've discussed the potential role of CPPD in some patients with osteoarthritis. But in this particular case, we're talking more about the role of excess weight, I assume, in causing damage, but does that also cause inflammation? So maybe you could talk about the studies of osteoarthritis of the knee that focus on obesity and what obesity does and what weight loss does.
Yeah, that's a wonderful question, Bob. So obesity and adiposity have multiple effects on joints, on the knees. They cause what the most obvious thing is, they increase the load across the weight-bearing knee. They don't increase load across the hands, something that we'll come back to in a minute, okay? And that load is actually not directly applied to the joint in us. What happens is that muscles contract to distribute that load and modify the timing of that load. And if the muscles are that cross the joint are working well, the excess load is often accommodated pretty well so that it doesn't cause damage. If muscles get weak, the muscles that cross the joint get weak, then we get into trouble. So load is a critical element here. And it contributes to cartilage loss and bone damage and the other elements of osteoarthritis that are familiar to us. The surprising findings were that we could find much stronger relationships between obesity and pain than we could between obesity and structural deterioration in the joint. And then we also noticed that overweight people and obese people had more hand pain than they ought to, in the context of often having osteoarthritis. And we found that if they underwent bariatric surgery, that all that pain got better, that their hand pain got better too, even though their hands weren't subjected to increased load. So it became clear that there was something more than just loading going on here. And then studies of adipocytokines, especially leptin, began to show relationships of high levels of leptin with pain, especially in osteoarthritis. So it then emerged, I think, in all of our views, that it wasn't just the loading of obesity was that was the problem, that there was another problem of adipose tissue producing almost hormonal effects on the joint, okay, that caused their own problems. And there were leptin receptors identified in the joint, and there were relationships between leptin levels and pain in a variety of studies. So the truth is, it appears that obesity causes osteoarthritis problems through a variety of mechanisms. That it induces inflammation, okay, both with the adipocytokines and by having elevated inflammatory cytokines in the bloodstream, okay, and that it confers excess loading that's problematic and can cause damage. There's a pleiotropic effects here. There's more than one effect.
So that all makes sense, and I know that you've already referred to bariatric surgery in improving knee osteoarthritis as well as the hand osteoarthritis. And I think the point that you've made that we've had previously on this podcast, but I don't think we can say too many times, is that all the osteoarthritis is a mild inflammatory disease compared to rheumatoid arthritis and lupus that are much higher inflammatory diseases, but it is not a degenerative disease. It's an inflammatory disease.
That's
That
correct.
that's a fair statement.
That's absolutely a fair statement.
Just before we go on, one of the podcasts I did was that very interesting study where people were given colchicine to protect their heart, and they had less knee and hip artificial knees and hips. And I assume that in some way colchicine is interacting with those leptins and other inflammatory processes.
It's a wonderful question. We're all intrigued by that study that found the colchicine prevented knee and hip replacements in a large study, cardiovascular study, over a long period of time. We don't quite understand what's going on because shorter term, smaller studies of knee osteoarthritis patients, trials testing colchicine have not shown much. So we're confused a little bit as to how it might be working. One of the ideas is that it might be working through the presence of crystals, one of which you've already mentioned, which is calcium pyrophosphate, that maybe a lot of patients with knee OA have microscopic calcium pyrophosphate, and the colchicine is really preventing that pyrophosphate crystal from triggering an inflammatory cascade and therefore preventing pain.
Anyway, so let's get to weight loss. So we've known that weight loss works.
Right.
And so now we have the GLP-1s, and most of the GLP-1 studies that I've been looking at for major weight loss are semaglutide and tirzepatide. So this article tried to do a cost-effectiveness analysis. Now, cost-effectiveness analyses I was involved in starting 40 years ago, and there's always problems with cost-effectiveness analyses, but maybe you could talk about, after reading that article and understanding the processes they did, there is a case to be made for GLP-1s, and there's a case to be made against GLP-1s, and I want you to debate yourself right now.
Okay, all right. So, in favor of GLP-1s, at least from this article, they meet criteria for cost effectiveness as a treatment for knee osteoarthritis compared to dietary interventions, compared to weight loss interventions that you might get from a nutritionist or from dietary supplements. The criteria are they have to be less than $100,000 per per quality per year. And these were, they were considerably less than that. If you gave GLP-1 agonists and compared the marginal cost effectiveness of them versus dietary weight loss interventions. So I must tell you that one of the reasons for that is that dietary weight loss interventions, which we've advised our patients for many years, if they have knee osteoarthritis and they're obese, they frankly don't reduce knee pain very well. Okay, you have to have a lot of weight loss in order for the average pain score to go down. The meta-analyses have suggested that you need 7 to 10% of weight diminution before you get any significant effect on your pain. Okay, so those dietary interventions don't usually accomplish that. And that's one of the reasons why the cost effectiveness study, comparing GLP-1 agonists, which almost always lead to greater than 10% weight loss, were cost effective compared to the dietary interventions. They frankly work better, and they succeed or surpass, sorry, a threshold that appears to be necessary to cause substantial pain reduction. So now that's the pro argument, okay? That they're cost effective, that they're more effective than dietary interventions, okay? And that they reach a level of weight loss that's likely to work, okay? So what's the downside? Well, the downside is, based on recent studies, that only about 50% of patients can stay on these drugs for a year. Okay, they cause frequent GI symptoms, nausea, bloating. Okay, they're sometimes expensive or unobtainable for patients because of insurance coverage challenges, and they require you to give yourself a shot, every week, and that's unpleasant for many.